We'll now move to agenda item 3. This is another informational item on the Annual Forest Practices Division's monitoring update.
Joining me today at the table are Paul Clements, the training coordinator, Adam Coble, monitoring specialist, and Ariel Cohen, monitoring specialist. But before I go any further, I do want to give a shout out for the good work of John Hawksworth and Terry Free, who are also instrumental in our monitoring unit. Next slide, please. So why do we monitor? We conduct monitoring to meet expectations in statute, rule, and policy. It also meets agency best practice to close the loop on the plan, do, check cycle. These expectations emphasize a collaborative approach, continuous learning, adaptation to new science, and a particular focus on FPA rules concerning riparian areas, landslides and public safety, and pesticides. To meet these expectations, the monitoring unit has developed and operated under strategic plans since 1994. The fourth and latest version of the Forest Practices Monitoring Strategy was approved by the board in November of 2016. The strategy provides a prioritized list of implementation and effectiveness monitoring topics. Recall that implementation monitoring questions asked, are the standards applied properly? And effectiveness monitoring questions ask, are the desired outcomes realized by the FPA rules? The monitoring unit has maintained a focus on high and medium priority monitoring topics with its completed, ongoing, and new work, demonstrated here focusing on roads, harvesting, riparian, pesticides, and reforestation topics on the implementation side, and on the effectiveness side, riparian, wood recruitment, and stream temperature and shade. This presentation will provide an update on our implementation and effectiveness monitoring efforts. For the implementation monitoring, we'll discuss the compliance audit contract that just ended with special attention on the 2017 results. Then we'll introduce our next phase of the audit that focuses on reforestation. For effectiveness monitoring, we'll discuss progress in two projects. The first is the Western Oregon Streamside Protections Review. The second is the Siskiyou Streamside Protections Review. Both of these efforts follow board direction. I will now hand the presentation off to Paul.
Good morning, Chair Imason and State Forester Doherty, members of the board. For the record, my name is Paul Clements. I'm training and compliance coordinator for the Private Forests Division. And I'd like to thank you for taking time today to take a look at some of the work we've done. This presentation is going to consider the Forest Practices Act implementation study that concluded in March. And it began in 2013. And in your packet, you'll have a copy of this report, and it's online. It couldn't be, and I've asked you to look at Appendix 3 if you have detailed questions. Let's see, okay. This began in 2013, and in 2017, again, 100 sites were visited statewide. They're illustrated here on the map. The pie chart on the right under Hillary there shows the distribution of the sites with regard to areas. And the sites were selected from harvests that took place in 2014 and 15 on units that were between 5 and 500 acres in size. And the sites are stratified by ownership and administrative area. The forest practices rules that are subject to this study reflect the fact that our rules are bundled in divisions. And we considered rules within the road construction maintenance, harvesting vegetation along streams, protection of significant wetlands, protection of other wetlands, and operations near waters of the state. And these are coincide with the priorities that Margan showed you about monitoring. The process has been the same for the length of the of the project. We hire a private contractor that gathers data in the field and provides an electronic download to the department. The department analyzes the data for compliance, and then each data point will have a decision, compliant or non-compliant, and we've done a quality control of about 10% of their work. Non-compliance, for the purpose of this study, requires three things to happen. One, the rule has to be pertinent or applicable at the sample point. And two, the rule is not implemented properly. And three, sediment deposition to waters or some other damage or administrative requirements were not met there. Data gathering on the ground. Contractors walk every stream and every road in the unit, and they mark the spots and take a GPS point and record their observations. In 2017, we had about 25,600 observations on 100 sites. And the compliance overall for 2017 is listed here on all rules together at Eastern Oregon, 98%, Northwest Oregon, 98%, Southern Oregon, 97%, private non-industrials, 96%, and private industrials, 98%, and others, which would include state forests and lands owned by family trusts and the like, at 98%. One thing that happens is that the contractors have made observations at the point where sediment depositions have been observed of the scale of that. So we can reference points in space and points within the sample where the negative impact occurred that is a point of that non-compliant thing. So of 100 sites, 71 of them had water present. In 36 of those sites, there was some sediment delivery for the non-compliance. And then the thing you might want to note is that the scale of those impacts is largely pretty small, less than a cubic yard. Here we have 1 yard to 10 yards and 10 to 100 yards. In 2017, we never saw anything over 100 yards as we had in previous years. And it's important really to where we're going with this is 65% of this is on small type N streams. These are the ones that we don't see sometimes in our planning operations. There may not be water in them, actually, when people set out on their business. So in a summary, you know, 2017, you have high compliance statewide, rule-wide, and we have needs for attention to certain details as we go forward. And one of the things about having a program over a number of years allows us to see if there are any trends in that we can consider. And so over time, we'll look here. These are the sample years we have, written plans. Here's a trend. We attribute this to a change in administrative process at the end. Roads and road maintenance is pretty, roads and road maintenance is pretty high and pretty flat, and we feel pretty good about that. There are still our individual rules that'll be continue to be a focus, not the least of which is the ongoing need for us to disconnect our streams from stream crossings, our road drainage from stream crossing, and placement of road generated materials on steep slopes. We still see that. And then harvesting rules, Division 630, again, high compliance statewide, and with exceptions, we continue to need to focus on the small type end streams, awareness and avoidance during operations. Division 640, 642, vegetation along streams, 2017, 96% compliance, and we have been looking at this, and we feel pretty good about this. This has been a flat line the whole time. And we kind of attribute this, I personally attribute this to the fact that we have a written plan requirement for fish-bearing streams, and that when logging units are laid out, if there's some planning and identification of resources that need to be protected, operators are responsible, and if they see a ribbon, they stop it and this is, we like to report this. Vegetation along streams, trends high. Significant wetlands, and significant wetlands are those greater than 8 acres. They're listed in statute as a specified resource site. First 2 years, we didn't see any. The last 2 years, we're between 194% on that. And again, these things are listed in statute as a along like an owl nest, if you will. Other wetlands, these are wetlands less than 8 acres. They occur on the landscape. We don't require site-specific planning for them, but there's an expectation that they'll be protected. As you can see, it's started off not so good, but it seems to have gotten better. We've been noting this in our trainings and outreach to industry folks, and I'd like to think that we're the reason it's changed, but I'm not sure that's really true. But this is what we're talking about here, is these small areas of wetland condition within harvest units that may or may not have been evident to people before they began their work. Operations near waters of the state. This is Division 660, and it concerns stream channel changes and beaver dams and headwaters amphibians. And it's at the end of the book, and it's been pretty good, except we still have a few instances where folks don't invest the energy that they might to protect the stream when they work. So these are some examples of what we've seen. Ongoing needs for improvement that we see out of this series of study is that, again, small type N streams are a thing we need to focus on in our harvesting operations because, again, that's where the majority of our impacts seem to be. The small wetlands, road drainage, and filtration at stream crossings, that's something we need to work on. The placement of road-generated materials on the steep slopes. Culvert sizing, we need to make sure we get this right. And the removal and stabilization of temporary stream crossings when they are removed. And so this summarizes work that's been going on since 2013. And I'd encourage you to look through that report if you have any interest. Again, in 2017, we completed all the field work. 2018, we'll take the data and we'll try to figure if we can gain some traction on it through our training and outreach plans, and that'll be an ongoing effort. Thanks are in order at this point. Barnes & Associates of Roseburg, Rick Barnes and his group, was the contractor, and they did excellent work, and it should be noted. We also appreciate the stakeholders support we've got from industry groups, landowner groups, individual landowners, the SFI, Associated Oregon Loggers, all have helped out quite a lot in sharing the message of the value of this work, and we appreciate that. So going forward into the next iteration of this monitoring work, we're going to look at reforestation. That's Division 610 of the Forest Practices Act. And there are different standards for different areas, and likewise, we'll sample different areas accordingly. We'll have 100 sites statewide. This sampling is going to be proportional by area to areas notified. We'll look at notifications that were listed as clear-cut harvests that were completed by December, the end of 2016. Again, we hope to engage a private contractor for this work, and the effort on the ground will be largely the existing protocols that our staff people use. We're not going to invent a new method or come up with this will be a much simpler endeavor than what we just finished because of the nature of the protocols are largely in place. And if their herbicide records are available for some of these sample sites, we hope to be able to capture some information from them as well because there's an interest in that. The next steps, we need to select the sites, get some landowner permissions, and screen the sites, and we'll list a request for proposal in ORPIN, which is the State of Oregon contracting website where people can find work that's available. Award a contract and begin field work in 2019, hopefully by the second quarter. And then, again, we're planning to do this through 5 iterations and find out what we can. So if there are no questions, or are there?
Yes, city question.
Yeah, I've got a question back to your definition of what is noncompliance.
Very well, yeah.
I would love to be able to argue your numbers, your C, the next time I get a speeding ticket. The law applied. I broke the law, but I didn't have an accident, so you can't give me a ticket and call me in noncompliance. So my question relates to, why do you have C in there? And if the rule applies and it wasn't followed, that seems like noncompliance to me, whether or not there were unfortunate environmental repercussions.
Oh, very well. The compliance of value for the written plans is such. Those are administrative requirements. And so if someone needed a written plan and didn't have one, we would call that noncompliant. The reason for not, we have the data. Right. We have the data on the conditions at each site, but we do report what is the degradation or the diminishment.
I think that's the
operative information that we can use to go on.
Okay.
And I can tell you, we also can say what percent of culverts and roads are partially blocked or completely blocked.
Yeah.
And that number is real and it has value, but we're not publishing that as a damage estimate because it, in many instances, doesn't lead to damage. The way we administer this program, mm-hmm. and the way that the message is carried to the land by our stewardship foresters is damage likely to occur. You know, we reference our efforts based on the presence or absence of a condition that could lead to damage. And if a situation on the land is inconsistent with a stated best management practice guideline, and there's no imminent damage likely to happen, we may advise a landowner and say, you know, it'd be good if you put water bars on that skid trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm not saying that the information regarding whether or not damage occurred is not useful or important. And it's sort of like it's important to know how many traffic accidents there are as a result of speeding. I'd like to know both how many traffic accidents there were, as well as how many speeders there were. And so for me, both bits of information are important, but they shouldn't be lumped into, you know, non-compliance shouldn't require damage to be non-compliance. Failing to implement the rule should be non-compliance. And then separately assess whether or not there were any repercussions from that non-compliance.
If I may, to be absolutely clear, this isn't a judgment decision of the monitoring unit or of field staff. This is the structure laid out in rule. So that is exactly the process by which compliance is determined.
So, okay. Cindy, some of the rules aren't prescriptive. So it's the right, correct analogy is if you're driving on a road where the speed limit is safe to drive, not a number. So our rules aren't, all of our rules, some of our rules are outcome-based as opposed to very prescriptive. So it isn't so many water bars per feet. It's a sufficient water bars to prevent delivery of sediment to the waters of the state. So the judgment of whether you're compliant has to do with the outcome, not the prescription.
And
so it isn't, we don't have speed limits everywhere. We have a lot of our rules are outcome-based.
And there's a lot of, at least there used to be, I think my son got a speeding ticket once when he was driving under the speed limit, but the cops determined that since he had an accident because of black ice, he was not driving at a speed safe for the conditions. Yeah, basic rule. So I understand that. What I'm trying to get at is you've got an A, a B, and a C. I'd like to know what the percentage numbers are from the A and the B, separate from then also what are the percentages once you put C in there.
The appendix of the report has all the observations, the sample size, and by individual rule. One outcome that we have that I think addresses what you're asking is the size of culverts. Were the culverts the right size?
Mm-hmm.
And damage hasn't occurred. The water's passing through the culvert, but the culvert didn't meet the criteria that's stated in the rule. Those are prescriptive, however. And what Peter talks about when it says apply drainage to a road in a manner that's adequate to keep sediment out of streams,
right.
If it hasn't happened, we can't report that it's not adequate to do that or not likely to. And one of the things that's in the protocol, which I don't want to get too far into, is we had to come up with metrics for proximity to streams and amount of sediment. What is it? Because we had to nail down things that are often done in a very analog way in the Administration of Forest Practices Act. And that's important to note. You know, this is not a study of the administration of the act, as it is just the action of people on the ground.
Right.
You know. And, but it's a huge data set, and it's really valuable in that respect. And we feel like we can capitalize on it for years to come, really.
Yep. Yeah. No, I think it's awesome, awesome work. I was looking for a further breakdown of detail.
Well, we'd be glad to go over the information that's in there.
Good. Thank you.
If there are no more questions, though, I'd like to introduce Adam Coble here. He's a monitoring specialist with our group.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. Chair Imason, members of the board, State Forester Doughty. For the record, I'm Adam Coble, monitoring specialist. I'll briefly present the Western Oregon Streamside Protections Review, which is part of our effectiveness monitoring update. I'll first lay some foundation for the two projects that the board directed us to do, which include Western Oregon and SISU. As a reminder, at the end of each of these reviews, the board may respond in several different ways, including finding the FPA rules are working as designed, finding the FPA rules may not meet stated objectives, additional study is warranted, or no action is needed. These projects assess riparian protections along small and medium fish streams. This figure illustrates the topics of the reviews. The desired future condition, or DFC, considers riparian stand conditions. We'll talk more about this in a moment. Stream temperature and shade are other major topics. These are both focused in the SISU region. And another topic we will examine is recruitment of large wood, which along with DFC are assessed in the rest of Western Oregon. Note that DFC is examined in both SISU and Western Oregon. So before I begin with Western Oregon, I thought it would be helpful to examine what DFC means, since this is common for both reviews. In the FPA rules, DFC for fish streams are to grow and retain vegetation so that over time, average conditions across the landscape become similar to those of mature streamside stands. The FPA rules also define mature streamside stands as being often dominated by conifer species, has a stand age or range of 80 to 200 years. The basal area retention requirements that are listed in the FPA are based on a stand age of 120 years. The FPA also describes mature stands as providing multiple functions, including ample shade, abundance of aquatic large wood, root masses along the edge of streams, snags, and inputs of litter through leaf litter. I'm sorry, inputs of nutrients through leaf litter. So for the Western Oregon Streamside Protections Review, the overarching question is, are the FPA rules effective in achieving the goals for desired future conditions and large wood? When we refer to Western Oregon, we're referring to the Coast Range, the South Coast, Interior, and Western Cascade georegions, but are excluding the SISU region. So we plan to use multiple lines of evidence to address this question. First, we'll be conducting systematic reviews on both DFC and large wood. Large wood is technically a part of DFC, but we've distinguished this from DFC because the Ripstream protocol had a question addressing large wood, and large wood is extremely important to land managers and sister agencies. We'll also be conducting an analysis of ripstream field data, which will include pre- and post-harvest riparian data. And we are currently exploring modeling stand dynamics into the future. That'll include growth, mortality, and regeneration. For the recent riparian rule analysis, the department embraced the methods of a systematic review for a few reasons. The systematic reviews include the development of a rigorous protocol for reviewing scientific literature, the use of a documented method to search for relevant literature, methods for data extraction and synthesis to avoid potential bias, and input from stakeholders and tribes can be built into the systematic review process at multiple stages. So we will be conducting a systematic review for both Western Oregon and a review in the Siskiyou region as well, and we'll talk more about that later. The systematic review for Western Oregon includes both DFC and large wood. For the DFC review, we plan to evaluate the effects of forest management on DFC, the range of DFC in mature stands, overstory and understory species composition and regeneration. For the large wood review, we'll be focusing on the effects of forest management on large wood recruitment, also the range of large wood in mature stands. And hopefully, we'd like to add more clarity into what might be considered an abundance of large wood, which is the language that's used in the FPA rules. Note that for both DFC and large wood, there are broad and somewhat vague terms used in the FPA. And so part of our work is to better understand potential targets by assessing the range or ranges for both DFC and large wood. For the field data analysis component, we're using the three questions from the original ripstream protocol, which are, what are the trends in overstory and understory riparian characteristics? What are the trends in riparian regeneration? And are the riparian rules and strategies effective in maintaining large wood recruitment to streams? And downwood as well in the riparian management areas. So we will be using data from the RIP stream study, which to date has mainly focused on stream temperature and shade. As a refresher, the RIP stream data were collected in 33 sites in the Oregon Coast Range, and that was on private and state land. The sites were at small and medium fish-bearing streams. And pre- and post-harvest data were collected on overstory trees, understory tree saplings and seedlings, shrubs and forbs, downwood and snags in the streamside stand, and aquatic large wood. So for our final line of evidence, is potentially the use of forest stand modeling. We are currently exploring how best to approach this and hope to make a decision by this winter on who will be doing it, what models will be used, and the scope of the analysis. We're considering stand modeling because it's currently our best option for understanding how stands will develop following the FPA rules and what stand conditions will be like in 120 years. We're currently unaware of any riparian stands that have been managed under the FPA for 120 years, so that's partly why that's our best option at this point. So that's it for Western Oregon. I'd like to hand it over to my colleague, Ariel Cowan.
Thank you, Adam. Chair Imason, members of the board, State Forester Doherty. For the record, I am Ariel Cowan. Adam provided some background on desired future conditions and the concurrent projects focusing on other Western Oregon regions. Today, I will give you an update on the Siskiyou Streamside Protections Review. The FPA asserts that the Siskiyou region is unique for its geology, climate, terrain, and vegetation. Riparian forests are different here than in other Western Oregon regions. Forest management is often different in this region as well. Acknowledging all of this, per the board's direction, we move forward with a separate set of streamside protection reviews, looking at this region for small and medium fish-bearing streams. First, we will be conducting a review on literature on temperature and shade. Second, we will review literature on desired future condition. Note that the protocol being developed for this portion of the review will align with the protocol being developed for desired future condition in the other Western Oregon regions. Lastly, we are working in coordination with partner agencies to provide contextual information on fish water quality for this region. The first portion of the review will address the primary question of what are the effects of near-stream forest management on stream temperature and shade. More specifically, the objectives of the review include an assessment of scientific literature looking at private forest management effects on changes to water temperature and whether those changes are within DEQ water quality standards. And an assessment of scientific literature looking at private forest management effects on shade and how they compare with shade measurements in mature streamside stands in the Siskiyous. The second portion of the review will address the primary question of what are the effects of near-stream forest management on desired future conditions of riparian forests. More specifically, the objectives of this review will include an assessment on the range of DFC conditions, such as basal area, species composition, ground cover, etc., in Siskiyou-specific mature streamside stands found in scientific literature. We will also use what is found in the literature to compare understory and overstory conditions of DFC with conditions found adjacent to or within private managed forests in the Siskiyous. Regeneration composition will be considered as well. The Siskiyous Streamside Protection Review will focus on topics related to habitat and therefore will not include literature on fish and wildlife conditions or water quality. In order to provide context on the findings of the review, we asked partner agencies DEQ and ODF&W to provide this information for you. DEQ will present to the board their information on water quality in the Siskiyous through TMDLs. ODF&W will present their information on fish status and trend in the Siskiyous. Both DEQ and ODF&W have also offered results from their own surveys for use in the Siskiyous Streamside Protection Review. This includes temperature, shade, and riparian forest data for DEQ surveys, and shade and riparian forest data from ODF&W surveys. So what is the status of these reviews? The Streamside Protection Reviews are currently in progress with the following achievements so far. Course timelines for both Siskiyou and Western Oregon have been developed for the review process that clarifies when and for what products stakeholders and tribes can provide input. Interested parties have been engaged through emails, phone calls, and in-person meetings to inform them on the review effort, the timeline, and to anticipate our request for their input at multiple stages. We met with local ODF field staff to inform them of the reviews and review timelines, as well as ask for other stakeholders to contact. We also met with DEQ and ODF&W to inform them of the reviews and associated timelines, initiate coordination for contextual information, and explore data products they may have that can inform both DFC and large wood. A first draft outlining the methods of the Western Oregon field analysis has been completed and has been sent to interested parties for feedback. Similarly, a first draft of the systematic review protocol for Siskiyou is near completion and will be sent to stakeholders and tribes for their review. The analogous protocols for Western Oregon are also nearly complete. Next, we will address feedback to finalize the protocols and apply it to our literature search and selection, and complete the analysis of the Ripstream field data. For the SISCU review, we will update you with preliminary results, likely next winter or spring. We will bring the final results for your decision on sufficiency of rules next spring or summer. For the Western Oregon review, we will update you with preliminary results, likely spring or summer. We will bring the final results for your decision on sufficiency of rules, likely in fall of 2019 or winter of 2020. Chair Imason, members of the board, State Forester Doherty, the monitoring unit would like to thank you for your time. We are happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Great.
I would just like to thank the monitoring team, and it's great to see the new faces here presenting today. So welcome to your first Board of Forestry presentation. Great job.
Thank you.
The clear commitment of when you'll be back as well. We do have public comment on this, yes. Mary Skurlock.
Protection Coalition. Ooh. I want to just make a couple of informal comments about the monitoring information that you all have received this morning. I'll start with my appreciation for the staff's inclusion of stakeholders in reviewing the upcoming scientific evidence review protocols and the methods for the analysis. Just a couple quick comments on the compliance audit. In general, we have not been emphasizing the compliance piece of this, just a matter of resources and focus. Of course, we've been focused on effectiveness, and we appreciate that there has been a consistent showing that compliance levels are fairly high. But I want to just express that that the slide that you saw about the sort of areas of improvement, given that we're talking about small streams and road-related issues there, those issues could actually represent fairly significant environmental impacts given the density of the road system out there and certainly the high number of small non-fish-bearing streams that we have. And while water may not be running in the summer, it's often running in the winter, and those impacts are important, and water quality standards do apply to many of those streams. So I just want to flag those as important follow-up items. While today we emphasize moving on to the reforestation, those are important pieces. And particularly, I also want to draw your attention to the fact that, and I know resources are limited, we're talking about 100 sites. There were 25,000 observations from those 100 sites, and it's a lot of acreage, but given the number of units that are harvested every year in the state, across the state, I have to question the sort of statistical significance of what we're able to say here. So I think it's really important information, and we've made a lot out of it, and I think that the data can be mined even more, but that sort of it seems like a small number of sites given the prevalence of these activities, so you know, I look forward to looking at that again, and I appreciate that we have not just focused on the aggregation but focused on the specific rules, because I think there's some very important information there on the effectiveness monitoring. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about some of the input that we've made to the staff about the Western Oregon and SISCU projects. One of the things we want to make sure happens is that the Western Oregon Wood Project explicitly re-examines the scientific basis for the current rules assumption that the functionality of a 120-year-old forest in riparian areas, which I understand we don't have a lot of to begin with, but nonetheless, that actually is the right target, that approximates mature forest condition that the DFC states and otherwise meets objectives. And we do strongly support the development of the modeling on the large wood, that would be an important contribution to understanding and being able to project not just the current management, but alternative management possibilities there. And we also think another thing to focus on in this has to be a sort of understanding that the increased occurrence of mass wasting events due to landscape-level forest disturbance and the large wood-depleted nature of landslide materials emanating from log slopes needs to be acknowledged in assessing wood sources and recruitment and overall conservation needs in riparian zones. So that's really part of getting a little bit more focus on some of the vagueness around what we're after with large wood and what's happening on the landscape right now. With regard to the Siskiyou, it's important, we think, that and you've heard this before in the previous rulemaking process that we were in, that the Stream Temperature Project must seek out literature, data, and analyses accounting for upstream impacts on downstream temperatures. Small and medium fish streams cannot be presumed to be adequately protected only by adjacent riparian protection. So in the literature, the what we know 5 years down the road from the last time we looked at this question, that would be of interest, I think, to this process. We also think that the ODF needs to examine in its context-setting literature synthesis the ecological basis for the assumption that has been made that ripstream data, which are being looked at with regard to DFC in the Western Oregon, are not actually relevant to the Siskiyou. There was a policy forum happening when we decided not to include the Siskiyou in the last rulemaking, but I think that it would behoove us to look at the literature that tells us what is the basis for this sort of idea that those data are not relevant to the Siskiyou. So we seem to be bucketing the data in this process now, and I think that it would be well served to continue to investigate that question and what the basis is for that separation. So our coalition remains very interested in both of these processes, and one of the we will be continuing to make input. And just one last thing I want to flag is that in talking about water quality standards, I noticed that TMDLs were considered to be context-setting information. And from our perspective, TMDLs and those load allocations for stream temperature are part of the legally enforceable water quality standards that exist. They inform what is required to meet those standards. So we'd like to see that information sort of considered at the front end in terms of what is the water quality standard that we're trying to meet in the Siskiyou. Thanks very much.
We'll take a break now and reconvene at 10:10 or 11:10 would be.